Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Today is Friday, October 19th, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Jim McCarty is Carla's husband, the scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Please visit the websites llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And the community website bringforth.org, that's bring, the number 4, th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I'll be asking Carla and Jim questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or you can join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty of LL Research. Hey, Carla and Jim, how are you doing tonight?
We are doing pretty well.
Quite well.
How about you?
Well, good. It sounds like you guys are having an exceptionally good week.
We are. It's Jim's 30th week in his mowing season, and he always has between 33 and 39. So we're talking about the last few weeks before his off season, and he does love his off season.
Colors of leaves here are gorgeous now. They're at their peak. Red, orange, yellow, maroon, a few green left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is at the peak. I was so glad I got out in my wheelchair, and a volunteer wheeled me around the neighborhood. It was so nice, and I just was able to see all this beautiful, beautiful country that we live in. And we live inside primarily, which I do because I can't walk right now. It's just a joy to get out there. And I was riding. I was just riding slowly in my wheelchair, and it was just delicious. It really was. We had a good time.
Everything's still green here. What do you do in your off time, Jim?
Sometimes in the winter I remove snow, and I do a lot of honeydew work. I clean all of the pots and pans and crystal and china and silver in the kitchen, and have a deep steam clean carpets, and, things the house needs.
Honeydew.
Honeydew,
okay.
Yeah. I've got a lot of my mother's things, and she always kept them in boxes, and I never understood why until I inherited it, and I got the boxes, and I was doggone if I could figure a place to put it all, because it's broken sets that she inherited from her parents' family, which were wealthy. And, when the sets got broken, instead of throwing them away, they put them in a box. So we have like 6 dishes or 7 dishes or something of a lot of different kinds of pretty old china and, punch bowl and just the most beautiful old, totally unusable coffee sets and tea sets and stuff. So since they're not used much, I did make a place for them. I was determined to get them out of the boxes. So when my dad and died, and the only thing he ever spent money on was the house. I knew that it would be okay if I spent money on my house. So I put the money in redoing the kitchen. And it costs a lot more these days than it used to. And I, among the things I did was I had 3 shelves that went up above the cabinets that were open. And I was able to put all the pretty things up there. And you can see them, as you walk past, which was the point, of having pretty things. And so, you know, in a year's time, they really collect it. So, you know, once a year, my sweet husband himself gets up on the ladder, gets the stuff down, and gently washes it and gently puts it back. Once in a while, I used to, when I was cooking and I had the ability to do this myself, I would get stuff down and use it. But the volunteers don't want to do that. It's like, give me a paper plate, would you? You know, so it's a new world. Nobody has tea. You know, they just give me the cookie and we'll go on. You know? And so that's that. Oh, by the way, speaking of going on, we are going to be absent. In a couple of weeks, we're going to be absent. We're going to a conference in Philadelphia at the Fuge, and I'm not... be very interested to see what all develops. A lot of people have been invited, and they're going to be asked questions, and then we're going to talk about them and share the answers with each other. And they're all spiritual questions, supposedly, or questions about spiritual matters. So the fellow really wanted me there, and he paid for three of us to go. From L&L Research, and I think it should be fun, you know, the most fun. And besides, it'll get me out there, and I am so ready to get out there. So, you know, it was okay with him that he had to put a hospital bed in a hotel room. It was okay with him that he had to get a potty somewhere and put it by my bed. It was okay with him that I needed help and I couldn't just come by myself. So all these things being as they were, I couldn't say no. Dress, you know, I get to dress for a big fancy party. You don't get a lot of chances to dress, you know. In my world right now, it's one of those, you just, okay, you know, let me find something pretty to sit in, because that's what I'm going to be doing today, and we need practicality above all things. So I think I have pretty things to wear, but it's not what you call party wear. So
it'll be 2 weeks from tonight, November 2nd.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so I'll be here next week, but not the week after, and I'll tell you all about it when I get back.
Oh, sounds like an adventure. Well, have fun.
Oh, okay, thank
so
you.
November 2nd, no show, radio show.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and go to our opening riff for tonight. This is from Kuo from January 10th, 1987. The very sunlight, the white-capped sea, and the waving, long-leafed branches of summer burst with the vitality of realization, for they dwell, as do all things, within the consciousness of love, and are part of the one original thought. Thus, one who is in a contemplative state, watching not the shiny face of illusion, but the face of the Creator within each illusion, may see that one original thought in color after color, distortion after distortion. Some distortions may seem horrible and some wonderful, yet all are the Creator, and realization lies within each moment's burden of love, which is infinite to the discerning spirit. Love cannot be seen by those who are not willing to open and call upon the consciousness of love. Thus, there is always the leap, shall we say, of faith, that states as a necessary assumption that the mystery behind all the things that are not is, in the end, the one thing about the illusion which cannot be denied, that is, love. We may talk about the terrible distortions of love. We may drag the name of love through the dirt of every battle and war that has ever been fought. We may deprive love of every satisfaction that has ever been given by poet or musician. Yet there is not one honest spirit that can deny the palpable effect of love within the life experience. Thus, the leap of faith is not so great, but only an optimistic telling of what each entity knows is the most creative and powerful force, illusory or real, within the creation.
Thank you, Monica. When I was in college, and we're talking, close to 50 years ago now, the big thing in philosophy was a total denial of anything that you couldn't see, feel, or touch. I don't know why, but it just had taken that turn, and it would seem to me to be mostly about arguing about words, what a word might mean. I guess it all started with Kant, but it had gotten really arid, and I thought that it had lost its way. It was not fun to read. It was not fun to talk about. I took a lot of philosophy, but I was the least fond of the newer philosophies that seemed to me to be mostly dealing in semantics, and as though they could pin down cookie-cutter words that didn't really have much depth to them, except that we use them to symbolize something that you know, everybody agrees that you see. And so you agree that you see it, but then the argument was sort of secondary. How do you see it? Why do you call it that? That kind of thing. So I had a friend who was very fond of this kind of philosophy, but he was also a spiritual guy. And he would, a couple of times he did, haul me into just, you know, he talked me into it. Oh, come on, Carla, I love to watch you work. He talked me into just sitting in the class so that I could get in a wrangle with the teacher about things that were and weren't real. And I would always argue that love was real. And I would slowly circle him, you know, and in the end pin him down, because whatever else had happened in his life, as Kuo said, there is not one honest spirit that can deny the palpable effect of love within the life experience. So it was a pull to get the person talking about objective philosophy, to admit that he had a subjective bias, that love was real, that you could not pin down, you could not prove, and yet he knew it was real. And that's really important to remember. It's important to remember because this is a very objectified world. We look at objects. We look at the way people look, the way we look, and are judged on that. We look at gadgets and are impressed by the newest and the gadgetiest, if that is a word. We could argue about that. Yeah. And we have a tendency as a culture to ignore or at least debase those things that are idealistic. The reason, I think, the one reason that we are not a socialistic country, the one reason that it doesn't make sense to us to take care of the people in our society that have gone so wrong that they have no money and they have no hope, is an objectified view of reality that looks only at people that are functioning as being valuable and people that are not functioning as being dysfunctional people and therefore not to be helped. You know, the basic attitude here is, well, they should get a job. What this translates to in the large cultural picture is an incredible lack of caring about dysfunction. But what it translates to spiritually is something that is even more subtle and is even harder to pin down. It's the reason that we have to burst from the bubble of culture, our own culture, that supposedly defended our freedoms, in order to have the freedom to think about things that have no right to be here because they work, because they are functional, because they are object. We have no cultural ability to appreciate the sunlight, the white-capped sea, the waving long-leaf branches of summer. Why? Because they don't do anything. It's the whole reason that we have been able to tear down forests, destroy the health of oceans, wipe entire species off the face of the earth. Why do we need that species? It wasn't doing anything. And yet philosophy argues, of course, in a cliched way, sorry, that one butterfly, more or less, in the Pleistocene era, makes all the difference today. We who are attempting to live our lives according to fourth density values of love and understanding have our only refuge in getting out of the box in spirituality. I'm not saying religion does it for everyone. I'm saying it does it for some. There is the attempt in religions to value the non-functional, the non-objective, the very subjective. Love. Love that sacrifices, love that cares, love that gives more than it receives. Not everybody can see the face of love in religion, and that is really why I started getting an interest in channeling in 1974. I was hearing messages from the Confederation that I wasn't hearing from my church. I was beginning to hear things that I really cared to be true that were so far out of the box that I needed to investigate it. And, you know, I don't know, 30 or 40 years later, I haven't counted recently, the channelings still seem to me to offer to the serious seeker some help if that person is oriented along certain lines. Or if not our work, other spiritualists that are not working in a dogmatic way, but in a mystical way. I think it's an age where mysticism in whatever coat, whatever coat or hat it wears, is all important to the serious seeker. Because we don't want to look at the face of war and see love, not as a culture. We can only see love in those ugly distortions of love by accepting the fact that in the end, all things are distortions of the consciousness of the Creator. And no matter how distorted those distortions are, no matter how they seem to be lost to any redemption, mysticism can always say and believe that there is a miracle waiting to happen around the corner. And I say, as a mystic and as a reader of these readings, that the miracles are happening right now. People are waking up all over the world and waiting to hear, waiting to see that thing that is going to make it possible for them to finally get it, finally see that we all are one, and that there is beauty in the world. It's simply been badly used. I hope that those who are listening and those who read our work will find that mysticism, will find that ability to move out of the box of cultural thinking, will find that positivity that lets the mark of the Creator in nature and in people be all that it can be that which we can believe in. I certainly am standing here saying that I will every day of my life intend to be a servant of that love. And it has changed my life completely to so intend.
Wonderful, Carla. Very, very eloquently spoken. Jim, did you have anything to add to that?
Shall I follow a symphony with chopsticks?
Yeah, how do you top that?
And I will just say also that she was speaking very well tonight.
Really, definitely. Okay, I'm going to go to our first question. It's from Wunderbar, I guess would be, I'm tempted to say.
Yeah.
Okay, Wunderbar. Wunderbar says, I have three cats, Peanut, Mac, and Baby. Peanut and Mac never go outside, but Baby lives outside and comes inside every day. But when darkness falls, he cries to go outside and stays outside all night, never complaining at the door. Baby is a talker and often makes a cute sound when he sees me. If I talk to him, he talks back with that sound, but I don't have a clue what he says. Peanut and Mac will do the same, but to a lesser degree. However, before I brought Baby home from a neighbor as a kitten, Peanut and Mac didn't answer me when I talked to them. Since Baby has been here, Peanut and Mac apparently have understood some kind of communication is possible, so they're now more vocal, which I find very interesting. I'm wondering what manner of spirit they are.
Well, you know, I think that whatever happened in Peanut's life before he came to you, I mean, not Peanut, but what was the third kitten?
Baby.
Whatever happened in Baby's life before he came to Wunderbar, Wunderbar, he was invested to some extent, and he was aware that there was communication possible through love, through the miracle of love with people. And he basically was teaching that love to the cats around him. They simply had no idea that what they had to say would matter. I'm reminded of an old joke about the kid who was healthy in every respect, but he never said a word. And finally, when he was about 4 and a half, he spoke for the first time. He said, "There's something wrong with this porridge. It doesn't taste very good." And the mother goes, "You're speaking. Why is it? Oh my God, you're speaking. Oh, well, you never spoke before. How come you spoke now?" He said, "Well, everything was okay up until now." And that's pretty much what I think was happening, that Baby was more invested with love, that Baby probably had been picked up and talked to and snuggled and patted and had no feeling that there were, that humans were outside the possibility of family. You know how cats make a, if they're lions, you call it a pride. I'm not sure if you call it a pride when it's a smaller cat. But at any rate, you know how they all snuggle together, and there's a lot of simple trust involved in that. Well, the idea of a human joining the pride was unheard of to them. And they were simply going their way and doing their thing and not aware that their life could be better if they talked to the human. And so it was really great that Baby gave P and M a boost, because I think that one of the things that we're here as far as animals are concerned is that investment of love and bringing them from second density to third. Have you ever seen that incredible video of a guy that brought a lion up from babyhood, because I don't know, the mother died, there was some reason that baby needed bringing up instead of, you know, with the mother that wasn't there anymore, and he brought this big lion up until it became so big that he wasn't able to keep it around the house, and then, you know, it was given into the wild to become wild. Well, I don't know, several years later, 10 years later, definitely a long time later, he went back, and this baby lion had become a huge, maned, wonderful big lion, and recognized him and dashed over and jumps up, and you're thinking, oh my God, he's going to kill this guy, you know, and he's doing nothing but putting his arms around the guy's neck, and they just are loving each other and hugging and hugging and hugging. It's just made me cry the first time I saw it. Do you remember that, Jim?
I sure do.
And then he brings the guy home to meet his family, and he tells the pride members, you know, this guy is okay, he's a member of the pride, and they all accept him. I mean, they don't jump up on his shoulders, but they they accept him instead of eating him, you understand. It took a tremendous amount of courage, I would think, for the guy to do these things. But it was a beautiful way to see that love really does make a difference. Love lasts, and you can love an animal, and the animal does love you back. And that's what's happening. So, Wonder Bear, just keep investing those cats with everything you've got and tell them how wonderful they are, and tell them if they can't come back after they die and be with you again, then maybe they'll be third density kids. We've had cats, Jim and I have had cats that have come back 2 and 3 times as we've gotten old enough that that happens, because they live so much faster than we do. And Jim, we've got one kitty cat that's a smaller breed than most for a American domestic, is a little Tom, probably 6 pounds, Jim?
Right.
And at 16, we'll probably not be with him too much longer, but, you know, cats can live 20 years, and we certainly hope he's around that long. Anyway, he still chases his tail. He thinks he's a kitten. But we've had him before as a cat when we had him as a tiny little Himalayan kitten that was very strange, but absolutely loved us half to death. It drove us crazy. Pickwick's much better. He's learned a lot since the days when he was, what was his name before?
Chocolate Bar.
Chocolate Bar. And then, Jim, didn't you say that the same soul had been with you before?
When I was in the fourth grade, I had a Cocker Spaniel named Trixie, and they all seemed to me to be the same soul.
They have, you know, some of the same mannerisms and so forth. And I think that's, you know, one thing that can happen is that, you know, either you share so much love, the cat says, I don't want to go on and be a third density. I want to come back as a cat. You know, I want to be with this person. And, you know, we're honored. We really are.
I've had cats come back to me a number of times. Right now I've got one that was my son's beloved cat. Well, we think she is. We're pretty sure. Yeah. So I've had that happen a number of times. And just recently, one of my friends from the forum lost a beloved cat, and he was just going through all this grief, and they had this beautiful little ceremony, this little burial for the kitty. And the next day, his wife brought home a kitten from the animal shelter that needed, because she volunteered, and she needed, the kitten needed extra special attention. And he was telling me, I don't understand, but this kitten just reminds me so much of this other cat. And she was doing the exact same mannerisms and all this stuff. And
oh,
it didn't make sense, because the kitten was like 6 weeks old. So I'm wondering if they could be living simultaneous lifetimes, you know, parallel lives. What do you think?
I think it's possible. I think anything is possible.
I mean, why not?
The spirit from the one that died could have entered into the spirit of the other one who did not have a spirit, was simply a second density creature until the spirit entered in. That's possible.
Oh, and you said about the lion. I've seen videos of that very thing with lions and gorillas and even bears, where they go back and the animal is an adult. And I just saw one recently with gorillas. It was really a tearjerker. It was really cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go to the next question. This is from Jake Rob, or Jack Rob. I'm not sure how he says his name. Hi, Carla and Jim. I want a relationship like yours. Listening to Jim and you on the show, I can feel the love and warmth, and it opens my heart. I hope you're healing and getting better every day. Thank you for your service. Sorry, this isn't a question. Oh, and Monica, I love listening to you too. Keep up the excellent work. Okay, thanks.
Yay, Monica.
Yeah.
So, I will assume a question is to figure out how such a thing can happen as a relationship that is somewhere close to the ideal. I think for Carla and for me, the foundation of the relationship is a devotion to something that's more than ourselves. From the first time that we met, we were both interested in being of service, and specifically of being service to the Creator, in the way in which we have been these last couple of decades, and that is through communication, through channeling, and through hopefully being able to inspire people into their own seeking. So we've had that as kind of an advantage, I guess, at least that's the way I see it, as having something that we both aspire to, and we both give our all to that, and we help each other do that. We know that it's the most important thing in our lives, and we it just seems to be the most natural thing to do is to help each other in that service. And, of course, it always helps if you're able to communicate and willing to communicate. I had to have a little coaching along the way, especially in the first years. I wasn't so able to communicate because I didn't have much experience with it. My family was, you know, the cowboy style, yep, nope, maybe. And when I joined Carla, I discovered that that didn't do it. You had to expand a little bit. You had to flesh out the skeleton there. So Carla helped me a great deal with that because she was such a good communicator to start with. And so I learned from her. And whenever we have a problem, we're both very willing to talk about it. And we have this simple ideal, I guess you'd say, and that is to never let the sun set on a problem. Work it out before you go to bed. Let it, you know, fester through the night and then pop up again the next day. So, you know, that willingness to communicate is invaluable as well. Carla, how about you?
Well, I think that everything you said is entirely true, and that was really what floated our relationship in terms of mutuality for a good 15, 16 years, even past the time that we were married. There wasn't much romance in Jim. His parents hadn't had much romance, and I don't think he was really capable of that kind of romance. I don't mean to be. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's true. Yeah.
And then something happened that you can't cause these things to happen. They just do. I guess it was the last time we actually had a vacation, which was like 16 years ago now, 1996. How old is that? That's closer to 20 years.
No, that's 16.
16 years. Okay, 16 years ago. We were at the shore. We loved to go to this place called Polly's Island,
South Carolina.
And it's a wonderful old place. I don't know what's happened to it since, but at that time, it wasn't a condo place. It was a place, some of wonderful castles and some shacks, you know, side by side. And everybody, you know, on the island found a way to get to the ocean, and that was really it was the summer place for, I think, people in Columbia. Was it Columbia, South Carolina, that was the biggest place that was 50 miles inland?
Right.
On the shore, you could always get a cool breeze on the hottest day. So I think the same way that people in New York send, wealthy people send their families to the Hamptons, and in Boston it's Cape Cod, I think in Columbia it was Polly's Island and places around the shore there. And we found a place that we loved, and we stopped being able to afford it in 1996, but up until that time, we went there every year, and it was great. I was a good swimmer. Jim was a paddler. He had taken swimming lessons, but he had asthma when he was a kid, and he got over his fear of putting his head underwater, but that was basically something that kept him from being any good because he didn't like to get in the water. You know, it was not fun. So he would, like, hold my hand because he trusted me. I swam like an otter and floated like a bar of soap. It was ivory soap. That was me, you know, 99% pure. And I loved to swim, and he trusted me. So we were holding hands. And it was the day before a hurricane, so it was a crazy day for the ocean. But actually what it was doing was causing the whitecaps to be frothy, and they didn't have any force to them. So we were jumping them, and we were having this fun and just enjoying the sun. It was a glorious day. And then we somehow lost hold of the sand. We lost our bottom. I guess we must have jumped out just beyond where it fell off a bit. And all of a sudden, Jim couldn't put his foot down, and nor could I. And so he started not panicking, but, you know, doing the best dog paddle he could, which was doing nothing. And I knew that I didn't have a lot of time. I mean, really, this can get bad fast. So I don't know what happened. I got behind him, and I was praying for all I was worth, Holly, help, you know. But that's what I call the Holy Spirit. And I just prayed, you know, come on, angels, come on, all unseen friends, help, help, help. I got to get this boy into shore. Well, I tried doing the, you know, the typical life-saving hold, and I was going out to sea, so that wasn't working. The tide was too strong.
It was a riptide.
And which I didn't realize at the time. I'm not smart about oceans, you know. We just went there on vacations, and this is the first time it ever happened to me. So we were completely ignorant of what you're supposed to do, which is to swim sideways. We didn't know that. So we found that we could not swim for shore. So I got behind him after I found that my life-saving techniques were, you know, gespürt. I got behind him, and I just prayed, and somehow the ocean firmed up behind me. It felt like a wall, and I got my feet right in his bottom, right square in his bottom, and I pushed for all I was worth, and he went in, and he got his feet on the sand, and he got out. But, of course, I was going out to sea real fast, and so I made myself as buoyant as I could by floating on my stomach and putting my arms and legs out. So I was sort of like, you know, a water bug on the water there. Nothing was floating down. I was also about 80 pounds at the time, so I didn't have anything holding me back. And I don't know, it wasn't more than a minute. I had time to think, well, this is a good day to die. You know, looking around, there was nobody else there. Everybody else had left the island. It was supposed to hurricane the next day. And we were just idiot enough to stay because, you know, we didn't want to go. And about 30 seconds or a minute later, a big wave came and just threw me into the shore, and I got out. Well, Jim looked at me and he said, "You are going to die saving my life. You saved my life, and you were going to die." And he, you know, he stopped repeating it, but that's what he was thinking. And I almost could see the cement cracking, you know, down around his heart. And he started laughing at my bad jokes. You know, I mean, he always laughed at the good ones, but, you know, there was a certain amount of critique going on there. And I said, "What's going on here?" You know, he kept laughing at my bad jokes, and he said, "I don't know." He said, "But I just feel differently about you than I ever had before." And that was where the romance started. And it was wonderful to have a romantic relationship. I had always felt romantically about Mick. He just floats my boat. He always has. He's a very handsome guy. Not that it matters. I mean, he's not tall, dark, and handsome. He's short, dark, and handsome, and sort of a black Irish guy with very fair complexion and dark hair, hazel blue eyes. His impeccability, his character, was always sexy. I've always found that to be very sexy in a guy when there's character there, when there's something to take hold of, and he was always very strong that way. And all of a sudden, I was getting back the kind of feelings that I'd had for him and that he'd never been able to return. So it took a decade or two to create the actual love relationship we have now. And it's a wonderful thing when it happens for both people. Unfortunately, for the majority of people, it's always one person that loves a little bit more than the other. And there's always some lack of balance. In our case, that just hasn't happened. It seems to have grown for both of us.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And, you know, he's taken care of me, not just this time for the last 3 years or so when I've been in bed and unable to do much, but I had a siege like that that lasted about 4 years around the turn of the 70s into the 80s, no, the 80s into the 90s. And he took care of me then. I was able to sit up and walk. I was not able to stand or to sit upright. I couldn't get vertical because my head had become too heavy for my shoulders. Now, my shoulders are still delicate, but in 92, I finally found a doctor that would support me. You have to have doctors to support you, or you can't get into places that will give you rehab. You can't just show up and say, I want rehab. You know, the doctors look at your x-rays and they say, no, I don't think you can do it. And then the admitting doctor says, give her a chance. And that's Dr. Blodgett, if he's still alive, thank you. Because I did get in there, and it was a crushing, difficult 3 weeks that I spent being evaluated and learning pain management and various other things. But I found out what I had to do. I was much better informed about what I could do, what I could push, and what I couldn't. And that information has seen me through even to this day. So at that time, Jim was even putting makeup on me. I mean, he was accessorizing me.
I learned what blouses went with skirts and what jewelry went with that.
In his lawn service, he'll be talking to one of his customers, and he'll say, I really like the way you've accessorized your socks and your earrings. That's just beautiful. And she's going, what? And all of a sudden, he becomes a very interesting person to her. Somebody noticed that I made an effort this morning. Oh, my goodness. But, yeah, he learned how to do all that because I was completely I'm much better now than I was then. Even though I can't walk.
Actually, you're walking with your walker pretty well. She did 6 laps tonight.
Yay! 6 laps around the house. It's a beginning. We're building from there. But, yeah, I can stand up on my very own 2 feet, and I can take about 6 steps. And then that's about it. I've got to have something to hang on to. It's a shame. But, you know, I'll get there.
Carla, I have a question for you, and then I have a question for you, Jim. Carla, my question for you is, what was going through your mind why did you just automatically save his life? Did it even enter your mind not to, or?
No,
I mean,
it happens, no. All
okay.
I cared about was that he was in trouble. He needed help.
Okay.
I can't say that it was logical, but, you know, maybe it was stupid even, but I'll admit to all of that. But that's what was in my mind. I must help this guy. He cannot swim.
What I'm getting
at
is,
I had a much better chance.
Yeah, because you could swim. Isn't this the very hallmark of the STO pass, of polarizing to the STO?
Yeah. I think I've probably been polarized like that all my life.
Whenever a situation arises that something needs to be done, she's always willing to do whatever needs to be done, and that's always amazed me. You know, to put herself out. So this was just the extreme example of that.
So, Jim, my question to you is, Carla, you did a great job. That was a wonderful story. I mean, I could feel the sand between my toes and feel the ocean. I mean, you really told that story great. But, Jim, can you share with us your perspective, if it's not too private, why that was such a turning point in your relationship?
Well, I wish I could tell you exactly how it happened, but it just happened. After she made that big push and got me in toward the shore, and I was able to get my feet on the sand and get to safety again, and she was able to, you know, be brought in by the wave, for some reason, I just saw things differently. I guess it's sort of like, you know, a few weeks ago when I decided all of a sudden it was time to become a vegetarian, and I can't explain either one of them. It's just like something went off in me, and I just recognized it. It wasn't like I had to make a decision. It was like the decision was made, and I just had to realize it. And for me, after the experience in the ocean, my heart just opened, and all of a sudden, she was just, she was woman to me. She was, the best I could imagine. I'd always been attracted to her intelligence and her individuality and her independence, but now there was this open-hearted giving that came from her just like as freely as the water flowed in the ocean. So it just seemed like it attracted it out of me as well.
Wonderful. And let's see, what was I going to ask you? There was something you said a minute ago. Well, two things. The first thing is you said about having something bigger than yourselves to reach for together. And I think that was pretty profound. I remember there's a saying, love is not two people looking at each other, but looking together in the same direction. Could you elaborate a little bit about having that spirituality being something that holds you together, holds your relationship together because you're both focused on the same thing?
Well, I guess it's been that way all my life. I've always felt that there was a direction in which I was headed that was appropriate for me, and I couldn't explain that to anybody. But I knew that at some point there was going to be an opportunity to realize my purpose. And it just seemed like when I met Carla that opened up. And I realized that she and I were both pointed in the same direction, that we were both wanting to do the same things, and we had the same core values, even though, we had obvious differences, and which made things more interesting. But at the core, there was this similarity. It was like recognizing an old friend, a very dear old friend, that here we were, and, let's do this. And so it just happened that way. I don't have a lot of clear and logical ways of explaining how these happen. They're, I think they're emotional, they're spiritual, these currents of feelings and purpose that have been flowing through me. I think that they've just brought us together, and we recognized each other and said, let's do this. And so we did.
He's not telling the whole story, of course, because before I met him, he had spent 10 years working on his own spirituality. He sort of woke up in college, and he became an activist, and then he turned more towards mysticism and decided that Walden was the way he wanted to go. And so after graduate school, he made enough money that he could buy a piece of land in rural Kentucky and, in the back of beyond. And he founded his own school, the Hummingbird Mountain
Research and Development Laboratories.
Thank you. And he made it a 501c3 organization, got it, all the tax stuff cleared. And which is a real difficulty for anybody trying to do that. The tax people are very suspicious of people who don't want to pay taxes, and they put you through it. But he had done that. He got the 501c3, and he did teach survival and opening the frontal lobes to people in nature, and that was his school. And he did that for a while, and he became more and more reclusive and ended up pretty much working and living all by himself. He still supposedly was doing the school, but he had a sign on the creek that a running creek was part of his driveway, and at the beginning of the running creek, boom, bidi-boom, boom, what was that? He put a sign that said, visitors welcome Sunday afternoons, and Sunday morning he'd take off. And he'd be back at the cabin sometime after dark. So he didn't see anybody except when he went to town on Saturday and got himself what he needed for the next week. He lived, built his own home, his own 16-foot square cabin. And I loved that cabin. Every inch of the walls was taken by something. It had a need of its own, and everything was beautifully organized. And he lived a very beautiful life, and he found us, Don and me, on a radio station, listening to a radio station, came out of Lexington, Kentucky, and he got interested in what we had to say, so he found out some people that also knew us and came up to visit when we had meditation, and he loved the meditations, and so he and a friend of his closest neighbor, lived half a mile up and half a mile out. He was in the valley and Eric was up on the mountain. They came together for several years to the when we lived in town. They came to our Sunday night meetings, and he started trying to learn how to channel. And at that point, Don and I agreed that we thought that he was great. Don fell in love with him, too, in the sense that he realized Jim's actual basic spiritual nature and thought that he would be a good spiritual part of the family. And so we asked him to join us and join our work. And after Jim took care of a promise that he had made to another guy, another channel named Paul Solomon and This Awareness Communications, he went out there for a short period and helped them. But he was told in meditation time to go to see Don and Carla. It's time to join them. It's time for the work. And he just came back and joined us in 1980. And 3 weeks after he came back, the Ra sessions began. And Ra said somewhere in the sessions that I needed the two of them as batteries to power the communication, that it was not safe for me to do such a narrow band communication without both of them. And that's why I never have tried to get Ra again since Don died. There's no way in the world that anybody else could love the way Don did. He was an incredible person. And then, of course, that's another story that is difficult to tell because he's not here. And you can, but I tell you, you spend an hour watching that YouTube a visit with Don and me that somebody put up on YouTube for us, and Don is talking about UFOs, and you listen to him for just that hour, and you get the feeling of the incredible breadth and depth of his nature and the amount of unbelievable purity of intention that he had. It was all about finding out what was real. That was, Don was a scientist. He wanted to find out what was really real. Well, he knew as a physicist that we didn't know anything. We could use stuff, we could make stuff work, but we couldn't explain the basic stuff. You understand, we could manipulate, but couldn't explain it. We couldn't explain gravity, we couldn't explain magnetism, we couldn't explain anything about how we use, you know, the things that we use and take for granted. Nobody really realizes the fact that, no, we don't know what that's like. We just know how to make it work for us. Well, it doesn't matter. It's working. Well, we'll not think about that. But Don did, you know, he really did. From the 50s on, he was absolutely on the trail of anything that he could figure that went beyond, you know, whether it was a seance or a UFO abductee. He was there, even if he had to fly across country. He was there. And he interviewed all the, you know, early abductees. And had he had me around in the 50s and, you know, a writer that could express, he would have had books out long before, but he didn't. And so the first book that he was able to get out, which I still think covers the field in a way nobody else has and gives you information that you never get anywhere else about UFOs, is Secrets of the UFO, that he and I wrote together in 76. You know, Don was the kind that could write an outline of it or page one or the other, maybe even both, but he couldn't get beyond page one much. He just didn't, you know, he wasn't much in this world. He didn't talk much. He was a silent kind of a fellow, except when he got on the things that he was interested in. And then you could, you know, he'd tell you anything you knew. He'd talk for 6 hours sometimes when people wanted to sit and listen. So, the three of us together were a mighty force. Don with wisdom, Jim with power, and me with love. That's the way it seemed to work out.
We're almost out of time here, so I just have a quick follow-up question. Since you said that Ra said Don and Jim were like for the battery for you, this question has come up, I know, from time to time. People always ask, well, is anybody else channeling Ra? And do you think that Ra may be communicating with anyone else, or have you heard of any such thing?
Ra said through us, and I'd never say through me, because it's always the group that fuels a channeling. It's not the person. That he had looked for like 200 years to find us. So I doubt if the Ra that spoke through me is speaking through anybody else. That does not mean that an entity calling itself Ra might not have interesting spiritual information. I never, ever talk down anybody else or say, no, that's impossible. And I do not say it's impossible that somebody might be speaking the same. What I say is look at their work. Read a little bit of the raw material and see how you think it's the same. You know, really? Because,
yeah.
You know, have to admit that that stuff is pretty eccentric and not along lines that people can, I don't think I could sound like Ra, frankly, if I wanted to.
There were three preconditions for the contact that Ra gave us over a period of time, and that was that there had to be at least three people in the group. There had to be some support for the channel. There could be more, but there had to be at least three. It had to be a question and answer format. Ra doesn't give sermonettes without a question. And it had to be the type of a trance in which the channel leaves its body and allows the body to be used by those of Ra. So I haven't seen anybody that meets those preconditions yet. I would hope that somebody else could channel Ra. I would love to hear anything else anybody is able to channel from Ra.
Yeah. I know everyone would, especially now. That would be wonderful. But we're grateful for what we got.
Yeah.
We are so very grateful for what we got. Okay. And, you know, we have about 2 minutes left. I got to ask, teaching classes on opening the frontal lobes, Jim?
Yes. Well, that was a course that I took in Colorado, Black Hawk, Colorado, in 1970 through 72. The fellow who there was, through about 25 years of research, discovered the primal nature environment provided a situation in which the human brain would, if the blockages to its natural functioning, move the energy into the frontal lobes into what we would call extra sensory perceptions and abilities and increased intelligence and so forth. So he had a program of how to use the primal nature environment, using your dreams, using essaying, using neurodrama to remove those blockages, usually just a handful that each person's been enculturated with, things that the culture doesn't know that is bad for the brain. And so that was what he was teaching. It worked for me, so I bought a piece of land and tried the same thing, and that's how I met Don and Carla.
It's funny, Jim was reading a autobiography of Judy Collins, one of our favorite singers from ever, and she talked about T.D. Lingo. She called him
Lingo the Drifter.
Lingo the Drifter. And she was in Colorado, and he said he never was new to the place. He always came in as if he knew everybody. He'd get himself something to eat and sit down and talk. And her dad, who was apparently quite a guy, loved him to death, and she was fascinated by him. She was a teenager then.
Yeah, both her dad and Lingo were DJs in Denver playing folk music at the beginning of the folk music revolution, I guess you would say. And Lingo actually taught her how to play the guitar.
Sort of sets it in a time and a place, doesn't it? For those of us who know who Judy Collins is.
You've got a certain age.
Pardon me while I get my cane, honey. I'm going to go listen to Judy Collins. She's still wonderful. You should hear her latest. It's just incredible.
Oh, she's still big. Cool.
Yes, indeed. She's made one recently, and it's just beautiful.
Okay. Well, speaking of time, we are out of time, so thank you so much, Jim and Carla. And Carla, you were particularly eloquent, and you said some profound stuff in that first segment that was just exceptional. So thank you so much for being of service in the way that you are, and the same to you, Jim. Thank you very much, and we're going to go ahead and close now. Join us next week. You've been listening to In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. We'll be here next week, Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. We're here every Friday, except we will not be here on November 2nd. No show on that day. Please visit llresearch.org. Check out the Law of One material and other channeling transcripts. And bringforth.org. That's bring4th.org. Have a great week.